Before we jump into this week's show, I have a couple of sponsors I want to talk about, starting with, that's right, the good folks at Lumi Labs. You know Lumi Labs, they are the masters of microdosing, and they want me to explain the benefits of microdosing using their Delta-9 THC gummies. If you're stressed out, or if your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. They're one of our longest sponsors, and I can personally vouch for their quality, as they've helped me fight off insomnia and the dreaded vampiric sleep schedule my body, for whatever reason, likes to default to. And the best part is, you can get them sent straight to your front door no matter what the marijuana laws are where you live. So, check out microdose.com and see their wares. If you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KINGCAST at checkout. And if you do, you'll get a whopping 30% off and get free shipping. That's microdose.com, code KINGCAST. And the next sponsor up, I'm particularly excited to talk about because it is the new novel from a friend of the show, Mr. Stephen Graham Jones. The novel is called I Was a Teenage Slasher, and I'm currently reading my way through it as we speak. Well, not literally right now, because now I'm telling you about ad stuff, but you know what I mean. I'm reading through it now, and it's already a home run from our boy. I'm very proud of Mr. Stephen Graham Jones. So the copy is, don't be surprised when you find yourself rooting for the killer in this summer teen movie of a novel gone full-blood-curdling tragic. It's 1989 in La Mesa, Texas, a small West Texas town driven by oil and cotton, and a place where everyone knows everyone else's business. So it goes for Tolly Driver, a good kid with more potential than application, 17 and about to be cursed to kill for revenge. Here, Stephen Graham Jones explores the Texas he grew up in and the unfairness of being on the outside, but from the perspective of the killer, Tolly, writing his own autobiography. The kills are poignant, the jokes will hurt, and the violence will be endearing. That's the Stephen Graham Jones special, baby. Be happy you weren't there. Be happy you're only reading it. And that just leaves... Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and is delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future. With all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including, from time to time, yours truly. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you'll need to subscribe, and to do that, all you gotta do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. Use the code KINGCAST at checkout to save a huge, gigantic, enormous 25% off your subscription. That's code KINGCAST at checkout at Fangoria.com. Now on with the show.
Hi, my name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes, that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINGCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Mike Flanagan.
And we are your hosts. We have an exciting episode for you guys today. We're not only welcoming Mike into the guest co-host seat, we're getting to talk to a man who got to embody one of the most iconic Stephen King characters ever brought to the screen in one of the most well-known genre movies of all time. You know him as young Danny Torrance from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and he's here today to remember in exacting detail every single aspect of making something when he was 6 years old. He promised me this, and I swear to God. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dan Lloyd to the KINGCAST stage.
Well, hi, guys. Appreciate you having me in here, but your expectations are a little too high, I think.
No, I think you know, you're gonna remember every aspect of making this movie. I want to make it very clear up front, like, you know, I've talked to a whole lot of actors in my time doing this thing, and a whole lot of them that started, you know, really young, and we know that there's going to be a lot of specifics that is the answer to the question will just be, I don't know, man, I was six. So we're going into this, full-eyed about that. But I do want to, obviously start by thanking you and for thanking Mike for helping set all this up. And, enjoy that guest co-host seat. Mike, how's it feeling?
Oh, it's intimidating. It's quite a shadow to step into. But yeah, it's so great to be here because, I've of course been on the King cast a number of times in the seat that you're in, my friend Dan. But I've never sat here, and it's an honor to be here and to be remembering Scott. Kind of as I heard you going into the intro, I got a little misty. It's an honor to be joining you for this. So,
no, thank you. Well, I think the listeners should know that in the wake of Scott's passing, there was a big question on what happens with the show, and the very night that it happened, you happened to be in Austin, Mike, and you very kindly gave me a little out from dealing with, my world being turned upside down, and we went and grabbed a bite to eat and kind of, remembered Scott and talked about that stuff. But it was at that dinner that you were like, I hope you continue the show, and you should consider a revolving guest co-host seat, which is an idea I've grabbed onto and will pretty much be doing, I think, until the end of the show's run. We talked a little bit about this, dear listener, back in our memorial episode we did for Scott. But, the plan is that we're probably going to run until December, and which was our original planned out date for the, bringing the King cast in for a landing. Mike, since it was your idea, I guess you get to kick off the revolving guest co-host. It's very also possible that you might not be the first one out there, but you are the first one we were recording. So if it's at all weird, it's my fault and not Mike's fault. I just
Yes, I concur. If this is weird, this is definitely Vespi's fault.
It's definitely Kate's fault if this is weird.
Yes.
We're in agreement.
This is all on Kate for sure. But yeah, what a joy to be here. And, for Dan, you had the incredible experience of working on one of the greatest Stephen King adaptations ever made with one of the most iconic directors of our time. And I'm, of course, talking about Dr. Sleep, the sequel to Stanley Kubrick's other film, The Shining.
Of course.
And that's something, that's an experience I think we all really want to dive into, is your day on set of Dr. Sleep, which is actually one of my favorite days of the whole shoot, which I'm sure we'll get there eventually. But it's such a joy to be able to kind of share this special episode with you. Our history, for those of you that don't, that didn't catch Dr. Sleep out there. I was so fortunate that I got to meet Dan when we were gearing up to make the sequel to the film we're going to be talking about an awful lot, which is Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, The Shining, and just found you to be one of the most fascinating and down to earth and just an incredibly kind of wonderful conversational delights of making that movie. And I remember the day you were on set, we were all running very behind because we just kept kind of peppering you with questions. And I know I had a really hard time going back to the monitor to keep the show going because I just wanted to keep talking. But I'm just so glad to be reunited with you.
Yeah, well, same here. I remember a lot of that day too. But if I recall, I don't think the kids playing baseball were too excited or their parents. Because they had to run around the bases a lot.
Yes.
And it was hot out there. And I started feeling the pressure, which I had not felt that way since I was five. So.
I was gonna say, wait a minute, Scott. Did you, or Scott? Oh my God, I did it already. Wait a minute, Mike. Did you because I've been on your sets. You don't do the Kubrick thing of doing a million takes. So were you with Dan on set? Were you like, I have to live up to this thing? And you made poor Jacob Tremblay run around that diamond a million times.
I tried very hard to kind of channel Kubrick just to make Dan comfortable. and that turned out to be a major challenge. But we were from what I remember that day, it was just tricky because we were filming the baseball scenes themselves. We had a bit with Zahn McLarnon kind of lurking over the whole proceeding. And then we had Dan who had dialogue, And I, if I remember, Dan, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I remember you got there and we did the first rehearsal, and then we shot, I think, the first setup, and then we started to go in for coverage. And I remember you were very delightfully kind of like, oh, right, we have to do this. We have to do this a lot. and it was really kind of wonderful to watch you reacclimate yourself to kind of the set rhythm, even though it was, you know, far truncated to what you had experienced on Kubrick's set. But yeah, well, it was wild.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's, and again, thank you for, you know, you and Trevor both, thank you for allowing me to come and unretire for one day. And it was great to be on set, you know, after 35 or 40 years or whatever it was. So I don't know. It started to dawn on me all of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, because it'd been a long, long time since I'd seen all that stuff.
But well, you hadn't been on set. Am I right that you hadn't done a movie really since The Shining?
You know, I did a couple little things. I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember when we had three channels and there was a TV movie of the week.
Yeah.
So I did one of those, and you know, it was the thing I remember most about that is, like, the director at the end of one of the shooting days said, "This has got to be some kind of record. We had like 15 setups today, or 20 setups, or whatever he said." That was the total opposite of the Kubrick experience. And my head was spinning. But anyway, that was, I don't know, I want to say probably 10 years old then.
Right.
So, but it was on location. It was on location as well. So it's still different than the soundstage.
Did you just kind of decide that making movies wasn't your passion at a certain point, or like, was it the industry that, like, turned away from you? Like, I'm very curious about that, and I hope it's not a sore subject, because, you know, I think you're fantastic presence on screen. So if it was the latter, it was the industry that was in the wrong. I'm just saying. So
no, I think it was right, and it all worked out exactly the way it was supposed to, you know?
Yeah.
I couldn't, you know, what I've done with, you know, going to school, and I'm a biology teacher now, and, you know, I love it, and my kids and my family in Kentucky. So no, I don't have any regrets about that,
right.
But no, I kept on auditioning for a while. I can't remember exactly when we called it quits, but, no, the industry spoke. But it was fine. By the time that, you know, it was a mutual decision with me and my parents. You know, my parents weren't stage parents or anything.
Right.
And, you know, we, thank God, you know, we did get an agent after The Shining, but we didn't move, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We didn't move to LA or anything like that. And, you know, that was just really smart of my parents to not dive in.
Yeah. To be fed in the machine. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a dangerous thing, you know? And, one of the things that when, I've talked to Henry Thomas about his kind of post ET experiences, you know, he was like, the thing he was the most grateful for was that his family didn't move to LA. It's so fraught, you know? And how did you get into it, though? You know, you said your parents weren't kind of showbiz parents. You know, how is it that you came to be in this film, and kind of, you know, working with, even then, one of the most celebrated filmmakers in existence? You know, for somebody who was kind of new to the industry, how did you get there?
Well, I mean, the short story is Stanley Kubrick decided he wanted, you know, a total amateur for The Shining, you know, to play Danny Torrance. So they had an open call to the public. I think the first step was send in a picture of your kid. So mm-hmm. I was four years old, and my dad, for some odd reason, thought it would be funny to send my picture in. You know, It was like a joke, or I don't know what, but, you know, and then you get a call, and then we ended up going to Chicago, which was, I'm from originally from central Illinois around Peoria area. Mm-hmm. So that was like a 2 or 3 hour drive, whatever it was. And we went up there to meet Leon Vitali, who Stanley, from what I know now, you know, a lot of these are not things I knew when I was a kid, but Stanley had tapped Leon to find the kid for The Shining. And I didn't know it then, but apparently that was one of Leon's first jobs for Stanley. Mm. And, Film Worker is a documentary on Leon's life. Leon recently, I guess not recently now, but Leon's passed on, unfortunately. Yeah. But he was Stanley's right-hand man. And so apparently I was one of his first assignments. So he turned. And so then, you know, once production started, he was my acting coach, and he was part of our cast and crew, was part of our family. But I mean, like, he was an immediate family member for over a year while we filmed. But anyway, so several trips to Chicago for auditions. And, you know, the auditioning process was really quite interesting. And I know Leon was going to other cities too. So I'm sure he was doing this in, you know, New York and LA and who knows where else. One thing that speaks to Stanley's genius, Mr. Kubrick's genius, and Leon's, is I couldn't read. I wasn't doing lines. It was, we're looking for a kid that can pay attention for more than 5 minutes, isn't too much of a pain in the ass. And, I look back at this now and I think this is brilliant. Leon put a camera up in the corner of the room, didn't turn it on, didn't do anything like that. Just put it up there. And it's like a psychological experiment. Is this kid going to freak out? What's he going to do? And so I kind of remember that. And he, you know, there would be exercises where, okay, pick up the red crayon, draw me a house. Okay, put the red crayon down, pick up the green crayon, draw me a tree, you know, follow directions.
Right.
All these kinds of things that if I look back on it, I think it's just genius what they knew what they needed from a young child on the movie set. And so anyway, so my realization now is that's not, I mean, don't get me wrong, it was hard work and everything, but I don't know how much I was comfortable with the camera. I don't think I ever had any trouble with that or anything, but gosh, I don't know how much of that was acting.
Right.
As much as just being precocious and, you know, I did fine in the adult world as far as like, it's just about, it's like having a job at 5 years old. So anyway, they knew what they were needing. And thanks to Leon coaching me, they really made me look good in the movie. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah. Well, I think you left off one important thing that they were looking for, and that was a kid that can pull off one of the worst 70s haircuts that's ever existed and make it actually look real and authentic and doable. The Prince Valiant, not too many people can pull that off. So,
yeah.
And you did.
You have to maintain, you know, the shooting took a long time. So they had to maintain that haircut and make it look the same the whole time.
And the shooting took a lot longer than you initially were told, right? Like that show went way over. And yeah. you're getting older, you know.
That's true.
Held in this in the haircut and everything else.
Yeah.
But how long were you in that world?
It was over a year. We were there in England for over a year. Not too much longer, but I want to say like maybe 13 months or something like that. I know we had Christmas there, and my mom had to make the Christmas ornaments because we were not expecting to be there for
Christmas.
You know, but we may do. You know, my sense is that everybody else probably knew, but we didn't know what we were getting into. You know, so, and did Stanley intend on that happening? Probably not, but in the back of everybody's mind is probably, you know, he could take as long as he wanted to make his movie.
Right.
So,
well, I guess a benefit of you doing this, you know, as your first real gig is that everything is strange and new and like, oh, this is just how this goes. So you weren't used to doing, like you mentioned, like the later TV stuff where they're doing, you know, 15, 20 setups in a day or whatever. So you're, as a kid, you're like, oh, this is just how this happens. This is how movies are made.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I just thought you hear 50 or 60 or whatever. And I'm not saying that every take was like that. Or I mean, every scene. But there were definitely some scenes that there was a lot of work on it beforehand, obviously. And then, you know, that when we started doing it, it was, yeah, again and again and again. And so I just thought that was normal. That's it. And, you know, so did my parents would kind of take turns, you know, going with me to the set, you know, but a lot of waiting around, which is normal for, you know, I think any filmmaking, but we just thought, you know, we just thought that's how you made a movie.
Now there's a lot of myth making that goes into this movie in particular. There's so much, I mean, whether it's, you know, conspiracy theories or, you know, whole ass documentaries, you know, featuring like, this is what he really meant in this scene. The Shining in particular draws a lot of strong opinions and strong, this is actually how it was kind of facts. And one of those that kind of jumped out to me is there's a story around this that you never knew you were in a scary movie. Is that true? Did they build it up to you so you never knew that there was anything like spooky going on?
I was definitely protected from anything that might have scared me. You know, we basically did shoot in order, which again, we thought that was normal. Oh, sure. You just, you know, progress through the movie, yeah. Which that's not right. Right, Mike?
No, that's not normal at all. Yeah, not even a little bit.
So there's a tension building as you go through the movie. And so, you know, it's kind of same thing for me as the actor, as a little kid, you know, what's going on here? But I was 5 and I remember my mom just kind of gently trying to describe the story to me, you know, like just the real basics. But you got to think, though, I mean, I don't, you know, we called them scary movies when we were kids. There's a scary movie on TV or whatever. So a little bit of that is, you know, I have no idea where, but somebody asked me that once. And so that for some reason that has been picked up on. And just I hear that a lot. But I mean, in essence, it is true. I didn't really, you know, you don't know what a horror movie is when you're a kid.
Right.
But I will just say this, that it became apparent as we filmed the movie that this is not a Disney film.
It's not a nice little family drama that's going on where you have a camera right up in your face and you have to look terrified and like you can't scream. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Why did I have to practice this, my scary face all the time? There was a reason for it.
The trauma face.
You have a very interesting kind of way into this particular podcast, because one of the questions that's always asked is, what was your Stephen King origin story? And you have an answer no one else has. Nobody else on this podcast, I think, has ever been in a position to say, oh, my introduction to the world of Stephen King was when I starred in one of the most iconic adaptations of his work ever made. You know, but you
now, Mike, you're making an assumption that he wasn't a big fan of The Stand and Carrie before he went in.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And I don't want to assume, but I do imagine, though, that you have a very interesting second introduction to Stephen King, because after you've wrapped the movie and after the movie comes out and does what it does. And when the movie came out, you know, a lot of people don't know this now, the movie was not a hit. You know, the movie was not received terribly well by the critics. It didn't do very well in the box office. It won a pile of Razzie Awards the year it was released. you know, it was not considered a success. And then, of course, later it's considered a classic masterpiece. You, at some point as you got older, would have had another Stephen King origin story, whether the first time you saw the Shining outside of your memories of being in it, and, you know, and then discovering more about this author whose story you were instrumental in telling. Was there a time that you picked up a Stephen King book kind of later in life that you recall? You know, was there a time where you got familiar with the world of Stephen King outside of Kubrick's set?
Man, there's so many different ways to go with this.
The funniest way is for you to go, I'm more of a Dean Koontz guy.
That just gets you right on the Koontz cast.
I'll just tell you my first memory of anything Stephen King, and that is my mom was an avid reader of fiction, you know, not just Stephen King, but I don't know how she had several, and this is I don't know if it was a book club or what it was. I don't want to guess. I'm sure people will tell me, but there's a paperback version of The Shining that's just silver and black. Mm-hmm. And it has, you know what I mean? I'm not talking first edition anything here, but, and there's just
it's just blank, like a head, right?
Yes. There's a blank face.
Yeah.
And now maybe I'm wrong about this. You know, I get that a lot because, you know, my memories are kind of mixed with what other people tell me, you know how when you're a kid and you have it one way in your head as your memory, but then other people will tell you, and so then what they're telling you becomes your memory.
Right.
I could have this wrong, but I think she had that before all of this started with me trying out for the movie.
Right.
But that could be incorrect. But anyway, I know that she had, other Stephen King books there.
Right.
And so honestly, being, you know, in the sciences and being a biology teacher, I'm not as much into the fiction as I am, you know, when I have time to read. I'm usually like reading an autobiography or something like that. I hate to break it to you.
No, that's fascinating.
But, you know, I will say this, that there were, because my mom, like while we were shooting, I remember my mom at some point saying, oh, there's the maze. Or something like, the animals from the maze are supposed to come alive.
Mm-hmm.
Or the hotel's supposed to blow up because they haven't been washing the boiler. Right. So my mom is like telling me these things, and she's not mad about it or anything, but she's just like, I think they're changing it. You know? So, and of course, later we find out that, you guys probably know this better than I do, was Mr. King originally working on the screenplay and then he didn't.
Yeah.
And then, you know, yep. So then, you know, I'm not privy to any of that background stuff, but, you know, I get, there's so many things that you can try to figure out what the revolving door was with what was going to be in the movie and what it wasn't.
Right.
And there's a scene early on where I've got that flashlight space gun on my hip.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that's the only day I had it. They're like, oh, get rid of that thing. We're not going to use that. Because somehow I was supposed to use the flashlight to find my way out of the maze, or I don't know. But anyway, so I guess my point here is that the book was kind of a character, if nothing else, just between me and my mom, because she was telling me how the book was. And then, you know, as we're going through it, but, you know, I think, well, I guess I don't know. Did we have no, we did. We had a whole script when we started. I mean, me personally, not that I could read, but, but so I guess he was probably set with how he wanted the direction of the story to go anyway.
Right. I mean, I've seen some, I think it's in Vivian Kubrick's documentary where, you know, he's rewriting, you know, on set, you know, on the fly, but you know, that happens with, with most productions, I think, you know, Mike, I don't know if you do that on your stuff. I think you feel like, based on what I know about you, you're more like, okay, I get it locked in, and then you can change and move with the input from the creatives around you on set. But you don't seem to be the type that are shoving new colored pages under doors like at 3 a.m., right?
No, I really try to get it all done, you know, ahead of time and kind of solve the movie in prep. In television, I've had to do rewrites on the fly, you know, that sometimes is necessary on long form storytelling. On the movies, I've tried not to, but I remember when we were researching Dr. Sleep, seeing some of the changed pages in the Warner archives and stuff, and some of the orders that came in for changes, I think, to the sets. And some of the changes to the story that became necessary because of the reality of the sets that I know he was always, I don't think Stanley Kubrick ever stopped kind of inventing what he was making, kind of ever, you know? And I'd be very curious, Dan, you know, I fully understand that your memories of this time of your life, if somebody put me on a podcast and said, hey, Mike, talk to me about this event that happened to you when you were six, you know, like much to your point, it would be a mixture of some memories of mine, a lot of stories from my parents. And then,
Pictures.
So I totally get that. I'm curious, kind of, are there distinct memories that do stand out for you of your co-stars in particular with, you know, you're working with Jack Nicholson, you're working with Shelley Duvall, Scatman Carruthers. You know, do you remember them kind of personally, or is it all more anecdotal for you?
I mean, I definitely have memories of them, dear memories, because even though I was so young, you know, I auditioned when I was four. Leon called me on the day of my fifth birthday to tell me and my parents that I'd got the job. And then, you know, most of five and then turned six while we were shooting. So like you were saying, those kids' memories, it's more than anecdotal, but yeah, it's bits and pieces.
Right.
And cause I'll catch myself saying, well, this must've been the first thing we did, but I say that about five different things. And so that's not how that works.
Right.
I guess Lee Unkrich's book is really what that's for.
Sure.
To keep all that straight. But I guess Scatman and Shelley probably stand out to me the most. Scatman would, you know, do voices and sing in the car. We would, I don't remember, not every day, but we would ride together to the studio sometimes. And so he would entertain me. And, you know, just stuff like that. Shelley was wonderful to me and my whole family. Her and my mom were kind of friendly for a little while there. So, and I should say probably of everybody, and we had letters and gifts and things, you know, over the years after the movie. But I would say Shelley was probably the best at keeping in touch. I think her and my mom kind of wrote to each other Christmas cards or something like that for a few years after.
Right.
So Shelley's really special to me and my family, really, because of that. She, you know, she let me and my brother come over and swim at her house. That she was renting, I'm sure, in England, in London. So, you know, we would see her even out, you know, other than at the set sometimes.
Right. You weren't hanging out at the bar with Jack at that age?
No.
Going to all the cocaine parties and whatnot? Yeah.
Man, I mean, this is the most obvious thing ever, but it must have been a lot of fun to be Jack.
At that era, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I don't want to, well, I won't be too specific because I have no idea, really. But I was supposed to meet Jack before we started filming. And there was also a rehearsal period there too that seemed to have shrunk away. I don't remember, but anyway, even before at the set at the studio, I was my mother and I went to his apartment to meet him, and we were going to go out for lunch. you know, so we're sitting in the living room of his apartment, and somebody is going back there to try to wake him up. Try, Jack, you're supposed to go to lunch, you know. And anyway, I don't, you know, to a kid, it seemed like we were there 3 hours. I really don't know how long, but right. We know, we just kind of took a rain check on that. So yeah, I'm sure he was up to lots of fun.
Well, how oddly appropriate to set the tone for what the fictional relationship between you guys was supposed to be.
I never thought of that. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's a good point.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if you've learned nothing, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? The catch is, there is no catch. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. That means they do not have retail stores or salespeople. Instead, they deliver premium phone plans directly to you. The best part is all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network, and you use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, bringing your phone number along with you. That means not having to reestablish your contacts or sending embarrassing texts to your friends and acquaintances and making sure all their info is on your device, all that stuff. Don't gotta worry about it. Now, we know most cell phone companies suck and are ridiculously overpriced, so I'm glad a company like Mint Mobile is in the marketplace to offer high-quality service at low prices. It's hard to beat $15 a month, folks. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/kingcast. That's mintmobile.com/kingcast, and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/kingcast. And now we're back to my favorite part, the disclaimer. Last time I tried this, I did the Micro Machines guy, and I fumbled a lot and had to do a lot of editing, so I'm just going to read it straight up this time. You guys ready? $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabits on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. And with that said, let's get back to the show. I want to ask you some specific stuff. I know, once again, with the caveat, you can always say, I don't know, man, I was 5. Something that I'm curious about, when I rewatch the movie, I look at it. One thing that's really striking and has become kind of a thing that, you know, generations now have done is the Tony voice and doing the finger thing. Do you have any thoughts or memories of coming up with the Tony voice and doing that, you know, or anything that you've gone back, you know, and in, you know, your adult years and tried to investigate that kind of stuff? I'm really curious about that in particular, the alternate personality of Tony.
Yeah. You know, earlier we were talking about Stanley, you know, maybe not having everything set up just the way he wanted, you know, everything's right, perfect before he started. So the whole idea of Tony was a confusing thing to me, you know, the little boy in my stomach and all that stuff. So I didn't know what to make of that. At some point, I do remember, you know, I would see Leon and I, Leon Vitale was helping me like learn lines and, you know, work on things and, you know, getting ready for whatever was next. It wasn't the first time I met Stanley, but, you know, it was still, here I go again, early on.
Right.
It seems like it was early on. Well, it had to have been. Right. And so he was going over with me, like, what do you think about if you did this or did that? And I don't honestly remember the other choices other than, you know, wiggling your finger.
Right.
There must have been other things, but like we didn't have any puppets or anything. So I kind of feel like he already knew what he wanted me to do, but he was just kind of working it out. And I, you know, I can't take any credit for this really, but you know, I do know Stanley kind of worked with me on different voices and, you know, but I don't have like a clear, distinct memory of that, but we did, he did include me in kind of the workshopping or whatever, the creative, or at least gave me the impression that I was having some input right. In that whole thing. So yes, I remember talking about that and working through it, and probably not a major decision made between us. I'm sure somewhere in there that's when he made his decision, because then when, you know, in the bathroom and at that apartment and all that stuff, the way we went with it was, you know, whatever he told me, obviously. Right. But yeah, I think we tried different voices and different things, and whatever he liked, obviously, is what we do.
Okay. Is there like a particular scene that you remember more than any other, like one that really burned its way into your memory?
You know, riding the trike around is probably when fans of the movie asked me just that, you know, what's your favorite scene filming? And that was probably it, because that was the most fun. And they were working out, to the best of my knowledge, they were trying on the fly, trying to figure out how to film that.
Yeah.
And so, geez, Mike, we may have talked about this already.
We did talk about it a little bit. One of my big regrets about Dr. Sleep was that, because we had rebuilt that whole part of the hotel.
I know.
But not when you were there, we weren't done yet building.
Right.
And one of my big regrets was we had an adult sized big wheel made so that all of us could do what you did and just kind of ride around. And there was one night in particular where everybody on the cast and crew, after we wrapped, would just take turns riding the big wheel around. And it was, you know, Ewan McGregor did it and Rebecca Ferguson did it. I did it. Just about every department head did it. They ended up turning the lights off on us on stage because we were just giddy recreating this thing that you did. And it was one of my big regrets that we didn't get to do that with you, because I think that would have been incredible. Like to put you back on the bike and be like, all right, you show us, take us wherever you want. And I would have just loved to chase you through there with a camera. I remember on set though, we talked about how much you remembered and liked that scene. And I think at the time we were still building the set, and I was like, oh my God, we're going to get to do that. But I didn't know yet to the extent we'd get to do that.
That's amazing. Did you guys have strips of carpet?
Yes.
My gosh.
And we had them over that little lobby so that we got that same sound kind of as we would jump on and off the tile floor onto the carpet. And it was, we had watched the movie so many times at that point, we had kind of mapped out your exact route for every time you had done it.
I think that was a happy accident, because the they sound? Didn't. Yes.
Yeah.
And I could be totally wrong, of course, but I don't remember them saying anything. Of course, they were working out, putting the cameraman in a wheelchair and pulling him and pushing him and doing all this stuff. They had a bunch of technical stuff they were worried about. And so I just remember them saying like, and it wasn't, I don't even know if it was Stanley, but they just said, well, ride that way. And I'm like, where? I'm in. This is a room, you know. My parents don't allow me to ride my bike in a room, or at least, you know, this is what I'm thinking. And they were like, no, just ride down there and go back around through there. And so, I mean, yes, the carpets were, everything was there on purpose, but I don't remember them saying, make sure to ride on the carpet and then straight through there. So you go on off. That part I don't think was on purpose.
Right.
I think you're
right. I seem to remember reading something about how even Kubrick was like, oh man, this isn't going to work because the sound is really jarring or something. And he had to be shown. Yeah. I think, again, this is not any sort of close to firsthand info, but I do remember that some of the legend around that is that Kubrick saw it in the dailies or whatever, and was just really like the rhythmic. It's very hypnotic, which is very much the tone of the movie.
Yes.
So, that's the legend around it anyway.
Yeah,
I can tell you just from our experience, the sound just happened. You know, even with our recreation, that was just the sound it made. And and I remember being, I thought, because we'd have to go in there and create it or take it from the original movie and distort it and come up with something, and it just happened that way again, even with our our kind of, you know, our mock-up of it. But yeah, it was really fun.
That's just my feeling, is that whatever route I took, because they didn't really give me any specific, but then, like, you know, like I said, they were trying to figure out how to do this. So I would come in and go around a couple times, then I'd go back, and then they'd come back again, and they were going to try it a new way. I seem to remember, like, okay, take that same path now. We like that path. It, you know, even though they weren't filming anything, I think the acoustics were, it was obvious, even when we were just rehearsing, that that's the way it had to be after that.
Right. Did you ever get the temptation to just slam on your brakes and let the camera crash into you?
Those guys looked like they were working pretty hard. Of course, I didn't know. That. Yeah, when they were pulling, because they were behind me for a while, then in front of me. And of course, I don't know when they've decided this is going to work and they start. I mean, I don't remember that much of a difference between when they were filming it and just figuring it out. But those guys pulling the wheelchair looked like they were, you know, working pretty hard. So, no, I don't think I want to mess them up.
Okay. Well, good. You're a good kid. You're a much nicer kid than I would have been. I would have been like, what can I do to fuck this up for everybody?
Well, you know, that thing was kind of a hybrid too. It wasn't, it wasn't like your typical big wheel with all plastic wheels. I think it had tires on there. So
it does. Yeah. I'm looking at the, we recreated it as perfectly as we could. And I'm looking at the one we built for Dr. Sleep right now. It's in the corner of the room I'm in right now. And yeah, it's got rubber tires, and your front pedals there. But yeah, that thing makes its own very unique noises for sure.
Yeah.
That thing encounters the floor. Yeah.
There's something very specific that you do. And this is a detail that I'm 100% sure wasn't like a conscious decision, but it's something that always jumps out to me. Cause I had a big wheel, like, you know, I'm a little younger than you are, but not by that much. I was born in 81. And so, you know, I had a big wheel and I did this fucking thing. And every time I watch the movie, it stands out to me as just something a kid would do. There's the scene when you go up and check the door to room 237 for the first time and it's locked, right? And you're kind of freaked out. Mm-hmm. Then you go back on the big wheel, and then you do something where this little maneuver where you, in order to get traction, you like push the rear wheel with your hand to get going again. And that just unlocked, when I see that, it unlocks like an instant wormhole back to me being like 5-6 years old, riding my big wheel around and having to do the same thing because I wasn't able to get traction with those rear wheels and you have to like force it. It's a little teeny tiny thing, but since we're talking about the big wheel, I wanted to throw that in there.
Well, yeah. You had to do that sometimes.
Yeah.
I remember riding those things outside and you'd spin.
Yeah.
And yeah. You'd be like Wile E. Coyote off of a cliff, you know, paddling away and not moving anywhere if you didn't do that.
That's exactly right. I don't remember if I was told to do that or not. I don't think so. I think it's because I think it was carpeted, of course.
Yeah.
And I probably was spinning some. Uh-huh. So I was just probably naturally just doing that. But I don't remember like actually purposefully doing it.
And it was your 90th time doing it. And you just know that you're going to spin out. So you just do it right, you know, just as a reflex.
Of course. Yeah. You know, I feel bad because everybody kind of picks on Stanley for that. So I'm sure we didn't do that one 90 times, but whatever the world record is, it's the ice cream scene.
Right.
And that was a lot of takes for that one.
So, and that's a lot of takes over multiple days, or just that was your entire day was just doing that one scene over and over again.
I don't know. I wish I did.
Perfectly acceptable answer. Once again, you can always tell me to fuck off with any of these questions.
Oh no. I mean, I'd be guessing.
Right.
I know at least one whole day. Yeah. I'm guessing we came back to it. Of course, I wasn't eating all the ice cream, but you know, they went through tons and tons of ice cream because of continuity and melting and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So that also makes me think that it was more than one day, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
Can I ask you, you know, the movie comes out, and wasn't a hit, kind of like we talked about earlier. And you move on with your life. At what point did it really kind of sink into you? Like, at what point were you aware that you were in this movie that was essentially becoming a modern, you know, classic, a real touch point for people? Like, when did you kind of really wrap your head around what it is you had done when you were so young and kind of your place in that legacy?
Well, I mean, you know, I still am a little bit, mm-hmm. but as far as when that first occurred was in high school, I think, you know, a basic cable was probably responsible for that movie, for The Shining becoming kind of the cultural, you know, icon or whatever, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And so that touchstone for people, I think it's because, you know, whether it was, you know, whatever channel that was on, it would, you know, it was seemed to be a lot. And, I think my first memory of it was, like for, you know, some Halloween time, it was like top 10 scariest movies. And like, you know, The Shining was 8 or something. And it was just, you know, that's not exactly it, but something like that, which was like a light bulb. It's like, well, geez, that's the first time I've heard about The Shining being on anything like that, you know, ever. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kind of, so what would that be? So probably like 88 or 90, something like that.
And how did people start treating you, you know, like how did the movie start to encroach on your life in high school and beyond?
You know, high school, it wasn't really a big deal. I went to a school with about, you know, I'm trying to think. I think there were 80 kids in my class, maybe. So pretty small town, you know, they're kids, especially, you know, after the first bit of excitement, they're over it and they're sick of it, which was perfect for me. That, you know, at that time in my life, you know, going through adolescence and growing up and stuff, it was not something I wanted to talk about a lot. And so, anyway, so that all worked out really well. But, especially because I wasn't auditioning in high school. I had already, you know, kind of given up that idea. So it was just move on. And I really like school. You know, I would have gone to college anyway, but The Shining really helped me go through school without having to have any debt. So I'm really proud of that, you know, and
All those overtime checks.
Yeah, right. Yeah. A year overtime or 6 month overtime. Now today, like I said, I would do it all over again. It was a great experience, but yeah, at times in my life, it's been a pain in the ass.
I bet.
But I am not complaining. I swear to God.
Is this one of those times that it's a pain in your ass where you're like, no, what am I doing? No. Talking with these jokers?
No, not at all. No. Okay, I'm honored that you guys invited me. I really am. And if it wasn't for Mike, you know, he gave me a great experience of like I said, now that I'm over, I'm 51 now. And you know, you get a lot more perspective on life and the things that have happened. And you know, it was great to be on set again, but I don't miss it really. It's a nice place to visit, but you know what I mean? There's great memories with all that, but yeah, there was a time when I guess it comes down to this. You're either going to live in that world of entertainment or you're not, and you can't, it's very hard. You cannot really walk the tightrope in between. And so around high school is when I wasn't, you know, that was, I'm not going to audition anymore. I'm not going to do any of that stuff anymore. So I'm going to be out here and I'm going to have to go to school and get a job and all that stuff. And so at that, when you're going through that, you don't really have much patience for that other stuff. I don't know. I don't know if any of that makes sense, but
it does.
I get it. You know, that's what I was going through.
No, and it, and it's interesting too, because I'd also love to talk about, you know, you might not be on set anymore, but you're actually, I think you're doing what might be the most important job that exists, you know, and has existed kind of throughout human history, in that you teach. And that to me is a vocational job. That's a, it's a remarkable thing. And, you know, we all get together in these kind of artificial worlds and spin these little yarns, you know, these little stories, and they pop like the bubbles that they are, you know, but can you talk about your life kind of outside of entertainment, which is the majority of it, and, you know, and kind of what you love about what you do, and, you know, and teaching, and what your life, you know, what your life is and became after this crazy movie.
Well, I guess, thank you very much for saying that. I really do appreciate that. I thank you from all the teachers for saying that, because, I don't want to overdo it. You guys all know the cliches. It is extremely rewarding. There's parts of it that are thankless, you know, and all that stuff. But, you know, I don't want to overdo it, because I teach at a 2-year college, at a community college. So I don't quite have all the headaches that are our primary and secondary teachers have. So it really is rewarding. As with anything else, there's good days and bad days. And, it was a little tough during COVID, and that changed things, and we're still finding where we're landing in that, at least in my kind of perspective.
I bet.
And it's not all bad. I'm encouraged. I teach classes that are, some are transfer students that are going to be going on into pre-professional, perhaps pre-med or pre-pharmacy or pre-dentistry programs. I teach non-majors classes. I teach classes that are for, like, I teach A&P classes that are for students that are going to get maybe a 2-year nursing degree or radiography or something in the, you know, one of those areas as well. Right. And so you're seeing these students of all different ages, you know, just starting out in that pathway. And it's tough. Don't get me wrong. It's just how it is. They're not all going to make it, because it's competitive, but you know, some might take more than one try, you know, but you get to see these students kind of stick to it and get accepted to the program and move through it. And then you see them, you know, working at a clinic or working at the hospital or whatever, and, or, you know, whatever they've gone on to do. And, you know, it's not every day or anything, but, you know, it's a really neat perspective to have, to get to see those people going through those really critical, important parts of their life.
I bet. Do you have any of your past life that like encroaches on the current life? Like, do you have students every once in a while that'll come up and go, are you?
Yes. Any? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
give them extra credit for that, or do you dock them points for bringing that shit up? That's the question.
Yeah, I think, I'm sure they're worried that I would dock them points so that they tend not to bring it up.
Right.
And that's because, honestly, this is going to sound corny or whatever, but, you know, I've got a limited amount of time, and especially now, it's a shame. There's not a lot of extra time in the in-person classes. So I would say this before, but I mean, it's really true now, but I mean, even before, it's like, this is the learning, you know, this is our educational area. And, you know, really, I'm just trying to, you know, play it off because
right.
there have been a couple times where students have brought it up, and it's kind of the worst kept secret at my school is probably the best right. way to put it. So, but I think one time I had a student ask for an autograph, and I said, you know, how far away are you from graduating? So I was like, wait till you graduate and then you can come back and I'll sign whatever you want, you know, just right. stuff like that. So I try to dissuade it because, you know, it's about the students,
right.
You know, that's, I'm being a little selfish there, but also part of that is true. That's one of the things there's so much online learning now that, the in-person is limited by time, you know, calendar time and time, you know, only so many hours in the day, obviously.
Right.
So when you're teaching in person, it really is a rush. It's critical.
Right. Well, I only have one more question for you, and that kind of falls into the legacy of the movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the weirder parts of it. How is it for you being at the center of probably one of the biggest and most widespread conspiracy theories of all time, just by virtue of somebody throwing a sweater on you that had a rocket ship on it at some point? Because I'm sure people listening know this, but you know, that everybody's used that as like, that's Kubrick teasing that he filmed the moon landing and we never actually landed on the moon. Have you had any of these crazies like pop up and trying to hunt down answers from that? Or is this just something that wholly exists online?
No, I will say that, there have been people that have asked me what do I think of that? Have I watched that documentary?
Mm-hmm.
And I always think, there's no mistakes. Everything in probably any Kubrick movie is planned, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, but maybe not. I don't know. But you know, like that sweater, I remember Stanley tearing up that sweater. Yeah, I think he started with just trying to rip it. I think somebody else tore it. And then he looked at it and said, oh, that's not enough. And he tried to tear it. And I think they even took it off me. And then they maybe used scissors or something.
Right.
But
you're talking for when you post going into the room and you come back and the sweater's ripped right. and you're bruised. Yeah, bruising.
I mean, that's the same sweater, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe so.
But they had to have more than one of those.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have. So anyway, so he picked that sweater. and they had more. I don't know whether it was made or bought or I don't know. But, you know, so they had more than one of them, right? They had to have. Especially yeah. one they were going to cut up like that.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that kind of lends itself into, you know, what is he trying to say?
Right.
It should go without saying, I don't buy into that conspiracy or many of the other things that I have watched part of that documentary, I did not watch all of it. Unfortunately, I could not stick it out and watch the whole thing.
I get it. Yeah.
But I get asked about that a lot. And I mean, I guess it's pretty cool for people to be so interested in it.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you get the best of both worlds. You get to be like, oh, well, that's really interesting. And you know, he chose it for a reason. And also the loonies have left you alone. So you get to, live in both worlds. So, yeah.
Well, I don't want to say, you know, loonies or crazy or anything like that.
I'll do that.
You know, just think about it this way. Isn't that part of Kubrick's magic?
Uh-huh.
Am I allowed to say that on the KingCast?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. We love Kubrick in the movie here, despite, you know, Mr. King's.
It's so weird. It's like, you know, it's like fighting, your parents are fighting.
Right. Tell me about it, man.
Yeah, really.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. But if it wasn't for Mike, I think Mike actually allowed Stephen King to like appreciate the movie I was in. I think he finally came around to, you know, having some appreciation for it, or, oh, you know, saying it was okay at least.
Yeah, he has warmed on it considerably, which is really incredibly validating for this little parent trap we all put together. So
that's right. Well, I think we have you to thank for that, Mike. I think I do anyway. But you know, Kubrick, I think, teases us with that stuff. You know, what was he trying to say? I've got no idea. Maybe he didn't either. Maybe he just wanted the audience to be thinking, you know, he just leaving these open questions, you know, or these open-ended questions for them to fill in themselves. I don't know.
Maybe he's a little trickster and just knew it was some red meat to throw out there. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that made him laugh. I don't, you know, there's no telling.
Well, Mike, do you have any final questions for Dan?
I've so enjoyed, as always, getting to talk to you and hearing your, you know, your experience both kind of within this movie and outside of it, and as someone, you know, who has had The Shining impact them kind of inwardly and outwardly, it's, you have a very unique and fascinating perspective, and I'm just really grateful to be able to spend some time talking to you again.
I mean, I am too. I'm really grateful. I really appreciate all you've done for me, Mike. It's really special. I appreciate it so much. And I love your stuff. You know, whenever something new comes out, I always try to send you a message. I know how busy you are, but I always try to send you a message saying, you know, gosh, my wife and I, we love this, you know, this new thing.
No, you do. You have done that consistently since we met, and it always brings a big smile to my face.
Well, and that's great. It's no BS. It's I was watching your stuff before the Dr. Sleep, you know, Kevin came about, and I really blame my wife for that. She's a real
she's a confirmed horror movie addict.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But not, I see what you did there, Mike.
Yeah.
But not what you're thinking, you know.
of course.
No, that's the other thing I did want to say real quick, as a child actor, I really have to thank my family too. And I don't get to do that very much publicly, but you know, there's nothing further from our wildest imagination that did my dad think that this was going to happen when he sent my picture off. But you know, the movie is shot in England. My parents have to leave their jobs.
Right.
My older brother, Mike, has to leave school, and it was only supposed to be for a few months, turns into a year. Mike has to go back, or they're going to hold him back. He's going to, I can't remember if it was his freshman year or whatever, but he was going to have to do it over. I mean, anyway, there's all these things that impacted my entire family. That, you know, that kind of get overlooked every time. So when you talk about, you know, Henry Thomas or, you know, any of the other successful child actors, you know, there's a family behind them that is going through whatever the hardship is at that minute. So again, it's not a complaint, but boy, that's, when I think back to all this stuff, it was a big family, exciting adventure that we went on.
Right.
But my poor brother doesn't get to, you know what I mean? I mean, at least I get to talk about this and this great experience I had. And I mean, there's some, you know, they spent time on set, and there's a great picture that I love of my brother and Jack Nicholson, not posed or anything, but just standing next to each other. Yeah. There's just some, it is, I agree. It's a crazy experience that we got to have, and we did it kind of as a family. So it wasn't just me.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's something that people do not think about when they look at young actors. They don't see the rest of the iceberg of that family that's behind that kid, kind of. And what these movies do we always say when we're scouting locations and we're asking someone if we can shoot in their house or something like that, you know, if they've never had a film crew come in, we say something along the lines of, we want you to know what you're getting into because it really is a herd of elephants that comes through your house. But when you sign up for a movie like this, especially as a kid, it's a herd of elephants that goes through your life, mm-hmm. and your family. and you know, my son Cody he's 7 years old. Last year we did this little tiny independent adaptation of another Stephen King story called The Life of Chuck, which I cannot wait for you to see. And I wow. can't wait to talk to you about it because I think you'll enjoy it a lot. But it Cody is in the movie, and he was really? I was thinking of you when we were on set because he was 6 years old when we shot it, and Kate and I debated about whether or not we wanted to introduce that into his life, you know.
Sure.
And ultimately we decided we were okay with it because he was with us and he was only on set for a day. And I was like, if we had no idea if he'd be comfortable with it, we had no idea if he would like it, or if he'd be frustrated or tired or annoyed or mm-hmm. any other thing. And he loved it. But it was one day, and I think of you on set mm-hmm. in another country for a year, you know? And yeah, your family, the amount of support, the amount of love that pours into, you know, supporting that kind of opportunity. That's an enormous thing. And I think it's awesome that you called that out, because I think even to the point with critics who can be really hard on kid actors, which is something I always get upset about when I read mm-hmm. that. It's like, you guys have no idea what it is to put a child in a movie, you know, like no idea. And it's amazing that your family did that with you and for you, and you know, you're part of an all timer, you know, when it yeah. comes to cinema because of it. But yeah, you're right. You know, they don't get the glory, and that's awesome that you called that out.
Yeah, I hit the lottery. There's no doubt. If you were going to be a kid actor in one movie in the late 70s, which one would you pick? Right. Yeah. And there's a bunch of other great choices. Don't get me wrong, but like I said, I would do it all over again because it would be The Shining. That's what I would pick. And it's fantastic for me because I get to meet fans of the movie, and they're Jack Nicholson fans and they're mm-hmm. Kubrick fans and a lot of Stephen King fans. Mm-hmm. And they'll ask me to sign a copy of the book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at first it was like, this is kind of ironic. Are you sure you want me to sign a copy of The Shining? But, you know, but now that I've been lucky enough to be in the Flanagan universe, it's okay. Okay, I won't feel bad about doing that anymore. So yeah, it's I do get kind of the credit for that. But yeah, my parents really, like I said, we didn't know what we were getting into. So I don't know if they would do it over again, but I surely would.
All right.
And the crew, I shouldn't, you know, I mentioned this only briefly, but you know what it's like, Mike. I mean, the crew is your family. And yeah. So, you know, for a year, it was, you know, they really were. And so we love them to death. And it was a great adventure.
Well, you definitely impacted, you know, I mean, you have your personal experiences. And I you know, the only thing I want to send you away with is that performance in that movie has hit not only the generation that was around when it aired, but is hit every subsequent generation as well. Mm. As Mike said, you're part of cinema history, and I'm really grateful that you took the time to come on the show. And while I'm handing out greatness, while I'm handing these out, Mike, I'm also very grateful for you being there on the night when, you know, one of my best friends passed and helping me through that, and very grateful for you for coming on and helping kick off this kind of new final leg of the show in his honor. So thank you so much, and I really appreciate it.
Oh man, it's an honor. I think Scott would have really enjoyed this conversation with Dan, and thank you, Dan, for being here. But yeah, man, I love you, Vespi, and I love Scott, and I love this show, and it's a real joy to be a part of it this way. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances. Yeah, I'm really honored to share today with you. So thank you.
Well, you killed it. So if you you have a future in podcasting if this whole movie thing doesn't work out. So
well, and yeah, and we shall see. The jury will always be out on that.
I was gonna say, and ... on that. All right. Well, thanks, Dan. Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate you guys both being here.
Thanks, guys. It was an honor. I'm sorry I didn't get to meet Scott, but I just appreciate it very much.
Many thanks to Mike Flanagan and Dan Lloyd. Never in a million years would I would have thought I would have gotten to talk to Danny Torrance himself, especially about, you know, asking him in-depth questions about working with Kubrick. And that was not a conversation I expected to have in my life. And I am so grateful for Mike Flanagan for helping not only set me up with Dan Lloyd, but stepping in and filling those very big shoes for Scott. I think I mentioned it on the episode, but this was the very first guest co-host I recorded after Scott's passing, and it was a little bittersweet. I think we got a little emotional from time to time, but Mike did an admirable job, and I'm very happy with how that episode turned out. And I got another fun one lined up next week, actually. As you may have noted from the ad read this week, Stephen Graham Jones has a new book out, which means, you got it, it's time to bring him back on the show. We're going to be talking about King's latest book, the short story collection, You Like It Darker. And I'll be joined by a new guest co-host, someone who's making his first KingCast debut, actually. His name is Neil McRobert, and he's the host of Talking Scared, which just happens to be one of Stephen King's favorite podcasts. And if you've ever heard the show, you know why King loves it so much. Neil's great. I've done a guest spot over on his show. He's coming in. He's going to help me lead this discussion with Stephen Graham Jones for next week's episode. It's going to be a fun one. I'm excited to have him sit in on the chat, and even more excited to hear whatever bullshit animal encounter story Stephen Graham Jones has up his sleeve this time. And this week's Patreon bonus episode is also a really fun one with a KingCast first timer. I'm bringing in my friend Aaron Sagers. He's a pop culture reporter as well as a paranormal journalist and ghost hunter. You know him from Netflix's 28 Days Haunted and the Travel Channel's Paranormal Caught on Camera. And he'll be joining me to talk about the real life stories behind some Haunted King locations, like the Stanley Hotel that served as the inspiration for The Shining and the prison where they filmed The Shawshank Redemption. We're going to get the background on all that stuff. He's a great talker, really great insight into paranormal, the kind of stuff that King taps into in his writing, as well as some of these really interesting locations that either served as inspiration or the actual filming locations in some cases for the adaptations. It's a really fun app. I think you guys are going to like it. So yeah, sign up at patreon.com/thekingcast to hear that and 4 years worth of bonus episodes. We have a new one up every Friday. So if you're only listening to the main feed, well, you're only getting half the show. So head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. And while I'm in promo mode, make sure to go load up the new show Scott and I put together before he passed. It's called The Spiel. It is to Steven Spielberg what this show is to Stephen King. This week's episode has Scott and I talking with Haley Joel Osment about his work on AI. And we debuted with Kumail Nanjiani talking about his love of Raiders of the Lost Ark. We have a whole bunch of really cool stuff banked. So if you're missing Scott's voice, we have a few months left worth of Spielberg chatter that you can fill that void up a little bit with. So go subscribe, listen, rate, review, all that fun stuff. And that should be that. So I'll see y'all next week for some You Like It Darker talk with Neil McRobert and Stephen Graham Jones. And this Friday, some Supernatural King discussion with Aaron Sagers. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.